Hi, I'm Liam O'Rourke, and I was the only SCG panelist not to make a Hulk Hogan joke last week, and I'd like to continue my support of the Hulkster by suggesting that in an effort to get his job back, he offered to sell his sex tape to WWE Films. Coming soon, Hulk Hogan in the Marine 5, Dishonorable Discharge.
I'm G. John Chase. Neither Carl or myself have actually prepared for this podcast, so we decided that we were going to do a typical Hall and Nash performance. Carl has turned up inebriated. I, on the other hand, are currently doing this podcast while sustaining a heart attack. I think it's probably fair that I go home fully paid.
I'm Carl Jones, but in 1999, thanks to my ability to bust out moves such as the Springfield Dance and the Garvin Stomp, as well as my ability to body pop, I was on the shortlist to be one of DJ Rand's backup dancers.
And I'm Kieran O'Rourke, and this week I've started a new Twitter account, at WrestlingProfit.com. That's wrestling as in wrestling, profit as in the Prophet Muhammad, not as in TNA will never turn A. Follow me, because the more Twitter followers I get, the more chance I've got of getting Sasha Banks on this show. That's at WrestlingProfit. Do it to it, people.
This is the panel for the 49th. Squared Circle Gazette Radio, and you can hear our show Busting McMyths next. Hello everyone, and welcome to the 49th Squared Circle Gazette Radio. I am Limo Rock alongside G. John Chase.
Yeah, hi.
Carl Jones.
Nitro, make some noise!
I'm Kieran O'Rourke.
Evening all.
And very impressed with your apparel today, Kieran. I'm the Women's Wrestling Champion of the World, Andy Kaufman t-shirt.
Yeah, so, I've got the best beard in the Divas Division, bar Tamina.
And we are very glad that everybody has joined us this week for a very fun show that we have titled McMyths. Actually, it was a phrase that Kieran, I believe, you coined that as well a few shows ago. Talking about, you know, the WWE's revisionist history, their stances on wrestlers and wrestling in general that have been perpetuated over the years that we're going to challenge somewhat today. So Vince McMahon's kind of in the hot seat, if you will. I just want to quickly mention the next show that we're going to be doing next week will be the 50th Squared Circle Gazette Radio. And rather than do a standalone topic, we do want your feedback. We pride ourselves on being a very interactive podcast, and we want this one to be the most interactive ever. So we want your questions, your comments, your grievances, whatever it is with the world of wrestling, past or present, and then we can obviously respond to what you say. So this is going to be a very fun show next week for the 50th one, so send your questions, comments in general to scgradio@hotmail.com, or you can post them in the threads that I post this link that you're listening to right now.
Or at Wrestling Profit on Twitter.
You're determined to get this Twitter thing over, aren't you?
Yeah, I am.
All right, so getting to this week's show, McMyths. There are so many. Again, we threw this out to you guys, the listeners, and you have not disappointed with the amount of different McMyths you would like to dispel this week. So we're going to start with Glenn Stewart, a good friend of mine, who says, "The one thing that pisses me off to no end about Vince, and now Hunter, is the brass ring bullshit. Not sure if that's specific enough, but I cannot stand when he goes on about that when he clearly pushes some people and cuts others off at the knees." So, this is one that it's actually one of the more recent ones that we're going to get to on today's show. This whole idea of Vince in his nauseating podcast with Steve Austin talking about the millennials.
Yeah, I mean, this is probably not in that terminology, but they all... I think in the mid-90s, it was, you know, the land of opportunity.
Oh, yeah.
The one thing we'll give you is the opportunity, and it's almost like...
No money, but...
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it was obviously the public face of the non-guaranteed contract.
Yeah, it's a pot small, to piss in, yeah, and some opportunity in there somewhere.
Small downsides. But, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's this reputation that they've kind of self-garnered from, you know, turning Steve Austin into a star and using Mick Foley well, and it's fucking bullshit. It's... They'll push guys when they need new talent. When, as we've been doing the Monday Night War reviews, when Sean's got a hissy fit or Brett's having some time off or Sid's playing softball, they'll elevate guys and make guys when they really need to. But in their eyes, when things are okay, as in the last 10 years of Cena, absolutely they do not maximise some guys' potential. They'll bring new guys in for their spot on the cycle, but in terms of maximising guys' potential, it's fucking bullshit.
Can't argue with that at all, Kieran. It's it's always been very much a case of they create more of a raft of new stars out of necessity, as you referenced the Monday Night Wars there. Whereas if you look at Vince's general MO, it's about creating one guy, one vessel. In the 80s, it was Hogan. In the 90s, obviously, the picture's a bit murky because of the Monday Night Wars, but, you know, he tried with Diesel, wanted it to be Diesel, and it failed. We've got, as you say, the last sort of 10, 12 years of it being John Cena. And I think the most frustrating thing about this sort of grabbing the brass ring argument is that a lot of the reasons that the talent in question don't necessarily grab this brass ring is for the most infuriating reasons. You know, more often than not, their appearance.
Yeah.
You know, take Brian, for example. Now, this may come up later on in the feedback, I'm not sure, about his WrestleMania main event. And the notion that this was all some sort of grand plan. It wasn't. He organically got over. Vince wasn't keen on him. Kevin Dunn probably wasn't keen on him. That beefy fucking looking motherfucker. God, I hate him so much. I'm with you, Corny. It panned out for Brian, but that was never the aim, despite what they try to tell us.
Yeah.
If that was the case, he's not losing at the Rumble to Bray Wyatt and not being in the Rumble at all.
And then feuding with Kane afterwards while Triple H is in the main match.
Yeah, exactly.
To your point there, Carl, Ultramantis from TPWW says, trying to pass off the whole mishandling of Daniel Bryan last year is their ingenious master plan from the very beginning.
Kevin Owen, being a more recent example, gets the win over Cena. At the time, he's instantly become the number two heel on the roster, I'd argue. The sales go down for Cena's merch, and all of a sudden, we've got to let him get his win back. And it's Kevin Owens. He doesn't look like a superstar. So, yeah, we'll job him out as well. So it's come more to the surface, I think, with fans recently because of that podcast. But it's something that's always been there in the land of the Giants.
I think it comes up as especially kind of nauseating now, when at a time when you can just watch the television and see that the guys themselves have got less control than ever over their own destiny in terms of what they can actually do on television and how much of themselves they can actually project.
Owen, going back to Owens, he's, you know, a great example to look at because he's obviously contemporary, but it's so obvious there was something there. I mean, there was something. I have an avenue to attract a different segment than the Cena segment. And that is one thing we'll say is different today, is that they are much more aware of different market segments and little bits here and there, but the overall thing is still the Cena one. But the Owens brought up, and they give him a little bit, but in the grand scheme, it's obvious he's just another upper mid-carder to move in and out of feuds and be just another mid-carder, and that's where most of the roster is.
I think Cesaro is another prime example of that as well. And I think that was the reference that Austin made that actually spurred that remark in relation to Austin talking about Cesaro, because he was a guy who got over, won the Battle Royal, becomes a Paul Heyman guy for, you know, a cup of coffee. The fans gravitate towards him, but before you know it, he's back to 50-50 booking. Vince doesn't really gravitate to him. I think he doesn't believe that Cesaro can cut through. And before you know it, he's just another guy as well.
I think that's kind of a key thing as well when we talk about this subject. If you're going to maximise a positive in a guy, you hide the weakness, but they use the weakness as an excuse not to push and maximise the strength.
And to Glenn's point, they actually completely overlook the real weaknesses that the guys they do want to push actually have.
Absolutely, yeah, so true.
Yeah, it's absolute bullshit, really, isn't it, when you think about it? Because, I mean, you just got to look at track records. You got to see that someone could argue that, you know, really you only need to succeed with one person every era because that one person can carry you through. But when you look at everyone else that they kind of always pinpoint, like Austin, as we've gone over on previous podcasts, and as Kieran always states, it wasn't as immediate as the King of the Ring 96, as they try and make out. It took a bit of time, it took a feud with Bret Hart, it took a superb match at WrestleMania 13, and then even then, that was just the beginning.
Yeah, I was going to say, Stephen Maniac from WrestleInform.com suggested the exact same one you mentioned there, the Steve Austin situation.
And, The Rock, well, it took a reboot and a different persona for The Rock to gather steam.
Funnily enough, though, I think that's exactly why Vince has this mentality, because like you said, in reality, I don't think that Vince has ever been really all that good at building a star himself. It's usually been through either a freak occurrence or the guy, like he says here, pretty much doing all the work for him, and him's going, oh, well, Steve Austin's the fucking biggest merchandise seller in the company, he's the only one who's stable, and Rocky Maivia is the most charismatic guy in the world all of a sudden, so let's push that guy.
Yeah, I mean,
as long as it suits with the company line, I guess, is the issue.
And I know Vince will like to take an awful lot of the credit for creating Hogan and the Hulkamania brand, but he had notoriety long before his WWF run. Okay, it wasn't quite on that level, but he was Hulk Hogan in the AWA. You know, he'd appeared in Rocky III as Thunderlips before all this. So there was, you know, Hogan was essentially already there. Vince just had to go and get him. He didn't have to create him.
Lord Peepness from the F4W message board says, don't forget that he took on the government and won. Given how business sank like the fucking Titanic and didn't recover for over half a decade, I don't quite see how that's winning. So, yeah, very interesting one here.
He didn't go to jail.
He didn't go to jail, so I guess that's better. But, yeah, the Vince versus the government, and Vince wins. Like, Vince actually took them on when the reality of it was that they were the ones that dragged him to court and had a rather poor case, as it turned out.
Let it be said that the McMahons aren't known for their hyperbole. I mean, what was the remark Vince made to Hogan during the build to their Mania 19 match? You testified against me in the trial of my life.
Yeah.
Jesus.
Yeah, I think anyone who gets, you know, taken to court for something and, you know, and gets away with it is gonna kind of, you know, bullshit about what they were going for in the first place.
Yeah.
So when they prosecute me for the steroids and I got away with it, he's not going to say that, is he? So
no, of course. What can you do?
I don't understand this one, but yeah, again, propagating of the McMyth that Vince is God and
unfairly brought on these charges, which is the richest thing of all.
Well, you know, he got away with it. So.
Well, I guess in terms of
so did OJ.
Yeah, well, I guess in terms of the actual charge of distribution, I don't know. Maybe I guess he probably was innocent on that charge, but. The bigger picture of his involvement with steroids in the 80s is quite out in the open, I feel, and it's kind of hard to... It's like, it just seems like the most, like, the smallest of straws to kind of grasp to in a situation like this.
Yeah,
it's
almost like the sort of the getting off on a technicality type of thing.
Yeah, it really is. And that's pretty much exactly what that case was. We had a couple of smaller softballs there, because here's a fun one. Jack and Ape from F4W says, the Monday Night War was McMahon versus Turner rather than McMahon versus Bischoff. Mickey85 from F4W also says, McMahon taking on Ted Turner pisses me off quite a bit. I can't explain why something like that gets under my skin, but it bothers me. What a fucking ego. Yashimaga from WrestlingForum.com says, I'll go with the fact that even though the Monday Night War leaders were clearly Vince and Bischoff, WWE loves to tell the story that it was Vince and Ted Turner. His galaxy-sized ego absolutely will not allow him to come to terms that he was getting his ass kicked in the reins by a second-rate wrestling commentator who got a lucky promotion as a WCW executive. Instead, he pretty much makes the claim that it was in fact Ted Turner himself that raped and pillaged the WWF talent pool, only to have Vince make the babyface comeback and topple the billionaire giant. Newsflash, Vince, you never battled Ted Turner, just his checkbook. Smelly Meatball from TPWW says the same one. Ted Turner's biggest desire was trying to ruthlessly drive Vince McMahon out of business, when in reality he barely cared about Vince. Cared a lot about wrestling since it played a big role in building his network empire, but never had a real vendetta like Vince does with WCW. Only got involved in the whole WCW-WWE war after the Black Saturday incident to protect wrestling on his channel. And wrapping up this topic, Colin Bollocks from the UK Fan Forum says the Monday Night War episodes are full of nonsense. My favourite is that they pretend Ted Turner gave more than 5 minutes of his time bothering about WCW or the Monday Night Wars or Vince McMahon. It makes Vince come off a wee bit sad, like this Mania where he lost his mind during the Sting Triple H match and decided to go to 11 with his bitterness.
Yeah, you see it countless times with the talking heads on numerous DVD releases. And I think the emailers there summed it up pretty succinctly. It's Vince and his ego. You know, Vince being Vince, he can't bear the fact that, as that email, the one emailer referenced there, he wasn't getting trounced by billionaire Ted necessarily, because, as we've discussed before, Ted Turner, whilst obviously being passionate about wrestling and it being a big focal point of the fledgling TBS cable channel, to them, well, to him, to shareholders and whatnot, it was part of a wider portfolio. It was just a piece of the pie.
A department, as Kieran called it last week.
Yeah, exactly. Vince and his ego can't handle this idea that he was being taken on by what would effectively be within the Turner organisation, really, in Bischoff, more of a middle manager. You know, Bischoff had higher-ups to answer to regularly, so Vince and his ego can't allow this middle manager to be taking on the king of promoting, you know, the Don, the man who took wrestling out of the smoke-backfilled rooms and out into
more
the mainstream.
More on that later, by the way.
You know, but as I say, I think the emailers there got it to hit the nail right on the head.
Yeah, it's actually kind of, you can actually, look, with the whole Ted Turner thing, you can actually kind of link it back to, you know, the steroid trial. It's that thing of, like, he comes off as the little man being taken on by the big corporation. You know, that doesn't work quite so well if you actually look at it the other way and you look at Bischoff fighting against the big corporation of the WWF. Bischoff had to come up with ideas, and the fact that he was actually able to gazump Vince, and he has to be the small guy, the underdog, fighting up. As you, if you listen to any of Bischoff's interviews or read his book, Ted would just simply just turn around in one of the appointments, the meetings, and just turn around and just say, so what do we have to do then? and Bischoff would just say something off the top of his head and he'll go, yeah, fine. It's not Ted didn't come up with that idea. He goes, okay, I've been watching the product, guys. I've been watching Vince and I think this is what we need to do. Bischoff, sort it out. Starts no fucking idea. He was asking Bischoff, for Christ's sake.
So hang on, you're saying that Ted Turner did not in fact have a PowerPoint presentation to give to Bischoff on how to run this thing?
No.
No.
He might have had the little pointy stick, maybe, to Ted, play with.
Ted just said, go and do it. I'm off to watch the Atlanta Braves.
At the end of the day, Vince is, he's a pretty good promoter. And
he's a very good promoter.
In your retrospectively booking a feud that you've won, do you go against the mid-carder or do you go against the main eventer?
Exactly.
And Ted Turner's the main eventer. So it's that putting himself on the same pedestal as the top guy in the rival promotion. And I don't know if we want to go onto this quite yet about how the actions of WCW against them were completely different to the actions of the WWF against the territories.
Let's go for it now. It's a natural segue. I was going to have a couple there to break it up, but why the fuck not? Let's just go full bore. This is the topic that got the most nominations for the myth that people wanted to bust and gripe with, a section that I've dubbed Poor Vince. Seldom Useful from F4W says, the utter hypocrisy that Vince complained about unfair competition and so on during the opening stages of the Monday Night War when Bischoff was basically using almost the exact same tactics Vince had used in the 80s to put the territories out of business. And also, the complaining of they wanted to put us out of business. Again, when it's Vince who did more to put a larger proportion of wrestlers out of work. Kowalski's Killer from Wrestling Forum says, I think the biggest one is that McMahon is completely innocent. That he tried to befriend every other promoter and they refused. That he wasn't trying to take over the wrestling world and the only reason why they're on top is because they had the best product. He was a ruthless businessman. There is no problem admitting that. The United States is a capitalist society. It's the name of the game. Admit it. Wrestling Oracle, also from WrestlingForum.com, says the semi-recent narrative of poor little Vince, unfairly blitzed by mean billionaire Ted, is such shit. In the 80s War for Syndication, BKM hyper-leveraged his mass advantage of the New York market with the home base allure of wrestling in the garden his father and boxing-wise grandpa promoted to household status. Combined with the financial advantage, barring, I think, the Crockett's, Vince used these advantages and his grand vision to clean the lot out in his death march. Besides, while Vince Jr. was way outclassed in media outlets, BKM sure as hell had a structural and product knowledge advantage. Lust Hogan from Pro Wrestling, and he also jumped on this one. For me, I would list the fact that WWE won't acknowledge that they put other promoters out of business in a very aggressive manner for the time. They act like it just happened. But Vince was offering talent loads of money to get on the rock and wrestling train. There's nothing wrong with what he did, but he always portrays WWF at that time way more sympathetic than it really was. We're not done yet with the nominations. Damien Ray from TPWW says, the fucking mom and pop gimmick they push anytime the Monday Night War is discussed. Trying to play the victim is some family company on the brink of extinction because big, mean, old, rich Ted and his checkbook in the relentless hands of dirtbag Eric Bischoff. The reality is they were getting comeuppance after damn near putting every territory out of business in the 80s, buying out high-profile talent with exclusive contracts regularly to the point where there was only one big dog in the game until Turner paid for stars much like Vince did before him. And finally wrapping this section up is Air Raid from the UK Fan Forum, who says that my favourite, without doubt, is that WCW were the evil to their good in the wars, and that Bischoff would pull what Vince considered to be dirty tactics. As you might have been so adept at pointing out in the Monday Night War timeline series, Vince always did and always will pull out whatever schemes he can come up with to intentionally damage the competition. From telling pay-per-view carriers to run Survivor Series instead of Starrcade in 87, or not get to run WrestleMania 4, to intentionally delay getting the 1-2-3 Kid's release paper so he could join the NWO, through to pulling out Bret Hart's return to nullify TNA's first attempt at running Monday Nights with Impact, even through to today, when I read they're going to run NXT in the same towns on the same nights as ROH. Vince and his company will do whatever they can to try and hurt other companies and will piss on any other bonfire, even if the effect is negligible in terms of making theirs burn any brighter. When Vince talks about, oh, you don't go there, on a DVD about something WCW did, I piss myself laughing. The truth behind this hypocrisy, I've always believed, is simply that Vince was jealous that the dirty tactics were better than his, and he doesn't like the fact that there was at least one element in which Eric Bischoff was clearly more creative than he was. Some eloquent,
yep,
eloquent stuff.
Who
there.
Wants to go first with that one?
Well, I think what's so frustrating about this one is, as a lot of contributors said, there's nothing wrong with what they did. We know it's a business, and I understand the double speak, the new speak when the war's going on. But in retrospect, why can't he just say, yeah, look, in the 80s, we out-promoted these guys with our resources. We used what we had, and we out-promoted guys. WCW, when we were stale, they promoted us, but god damn it, we stepped up our game and got even better. There's nothing wrong with that. It's like, it's,
there is a story to tell.
It's non-offensive, I think, but just, it's, yeah, it's just mind-boggling to anyone who has any fucking clue that they'd they keep perpetuating the myth of Big Bad Ted and Mum and Pop, and Co. Yeah,
it's one of those where you're wishing for him to just show up, be a bit more magnanimous in victory. Again, it goes back to Vince's ego, because he can't allow himself to acknowledge that a lot of these promoters in the 80s weren't cotton on to the advent of cable TV, weren't able to sort of go along with the changing times. And for to tell the accurate story of the Monday Night Wars, he then has to acknowledge, I became those old promoters that I put out of business, and he just can't bring himself to do it.
No. And that was that great line that we mentioned in one of the timelines where Bischoff had the line, Vince McMahon is the Vern Gagne of the 90s, which I think plays into a lot of why Vince has this myth in his mind, because he hates the idea. I think he really hates the idea that he has the possibility, like us mere mortals, to be regressive or get stuck in place, when in reality that is exactly what's happened, and it's happened before.
As Kieran said, as the emailer said, there's nothing wrong with what Vince did, in the sense of, you know, all's fair in love and war. It's the way it's presented now in retrospect that's great. And I mean, you only have to look at the, you mentioned Vern Gagne there, and you only have to look at the AWA. Yes, Vern was asleep at the wheel, lost Hogan through his own piss poor management, lost the likes of Heenan, you know, Ventura, etc., and obviously they were able to leverage
Oakland,
and they were able to leverage New York as a way to attract these stars in as well. But Vince was so petty, he took the likes of fucking Ken Resnick.
Yeah, he's taking all the, he took production staff.
Yeah, it's, you know, and there's, you know, like I say, all's fair in love and war, but just be upfront and be man enough to acknowledge that. I think anyone like Kieran said who's got any clue knows that this is all bullshit. And if you want to get a real good insight into how Vince really is when it comes to WCW and the Monday Night War, just watch that final Raw that goes head to head with Nitro, because that is the truth, ladies and gentlemen.
What is victory a lap speech?
That's the one.
The moral of the story, I think Napoleon said it in Churchill's, you know, history is written by the winners.
Oh, it absolutely is. Absolutely is, yeah. The thing that I love about it is just the sheer gall it takes.
But do you think he actually believes it himself?
I don't know. I think maybe... Do you reckon he's convinced himself that this McMyth is real?
That's what I was thinking. This, we say it's so ridiculous that it's propagated on the mass scale, but it's his company. It's his eyes. It's, we see the way he wants us to see. And is it a intentional distortion of history, or is it honestly how he saw things from his perspective?
Oh yeah, we've seen this historically with Vince, where there are things he does that are fine for him to do, but when the shoe is on the other foot, and we'll see this in later examples that people have written in, he can't stand it. And just to your point, Carl, about the pettiness, it's absolutely okay for him to go into a building that WCW are going to run a pay-per-view in the next day, run a house show there that runs until 2 in the morning to delay the production staff from getting in, putting on intentionally a boring, long, agonising show to try and kill walk-up for the next day. That's the kind of thing that he did all the time in the 80s.
How many buildings did he attempt to get WCW locked out
of? Oh, but yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I just think Vince is demented, to be honest with you.
Yeah,
absolutely demented. It's just, again, it goes back to this. He has to be the underdog, so he will skirt over the early 80s and his acquisition. You know, you can get like talking heads like Jim Crockett and so on all talking about like what he was like, but Vince will never comment on that. There's rarely anything. If you look back at all these documentaries that he's done, he rarely ever comments on it. But like, if you want to talk to him about the Monday Night Wars,
oh, he's all too
happy. Oh yeah, he can't shut the fucker up. You know, he'll go on about how like, oh, I almost lost everything. My family were almost out on the streets because of it. And it's just like, well, that's bullshit for starters. But it's just,
well, the posse would have put Shane up.
I'm sure they would.
There's a spare room at Willie Green's.
There's a spare sweater vest for Shane's back. When you're living within this bubble, where the bubble itself is its own existence outside of reality, then it's not too hard pressed to actually kind of realise that the inverted commas, the god of this alternative reality, Vince McMahon, will actually believe his own shit. Just to slightly go off track, but in relevance to this, I was thinking of the moment recently on the Stone Cold podcast, which he did with Vince, and Vince says that line to Austin about the title. If you remember that, when he says, like, the title doesn't really mean anything. It's just a prop. And Austin gives him this look of like he's just raped his mom or something. You know, it was just like Vince is looking back at him. Austin's staring bullets for him, and Vince is just staring right back at him with no shame or no kind of like, all right, you caught me, I was lying there. Vince absolutely believes it, and it's because he's screwed over the title over the last 10 years that the title actually does mean nothing now. And so because it doesn't mean anything, he now just believes that it's now just a prop. And so it's only on these few occasions where you get someone like, well, I guess general fans like us, or an Austin, who can't be, you know, the wool can't be pulled over his eyes, look at him as if he's fucking demented.
I just find this one so fascinating, because it does take such gall to complain about, oh, you read the results on your show, Nitro, because our show was taped. But meanwhile, it's okay for him to, you know, try and fucking cancel other people's pay-per-views and shit like that, you know?
Off. How much money did he offer Harley Race to no-show the first Starrcade?
Yeah, exactly.
The one thing I'll say is maybe we shouldn't be too offended by it, because wrestling's a work.
Yeah.
And you know what? Maybe he's the only one who actually remembers it's a work, and he's actually working us all the time.
Of course,
you know,
he is.
It's his fucking company, so he'll work when he wants to work. I just think in this modern era of reality and fucking fake reality TV anyway, but whatever. But people want to believe it. So we want to believe he's going to tell the truth. But you know what? Fuck it, it's his show. He'll work when he wants to work, goddammit. And that's all the time he's on TV.
So. Just want to get to another contribution here from Otto Dem Vons from the UK Fan Forum. Says the excessive disparaging of WCW that takes place on WWE programming particularly bothers me during the Sting versus Triple H feud. JBL and Cole's disgraceful hatchet job on Sting's career during the WrestleMania match, implying WCW was essentially a B-league full of no-marks, was both unnecessary and inaccurate. The fact they feel the need to downplay everything Sting did in WCW 14 years after the company ceased functioning only tells me McMahon is a deeply insecure human being who has never got over the fact Bischoff got the better of him during that 2-year period. Doctor Who's Next from the UK Fan Forum says, add my name to revisionist history when it comes to WCW. The two which stick out for me are both centered around the Monday Night War series on the network. On the Goldberg episode, they cut to a load of fans booing Goldberg, saying they're tiring of his act, when in actual fact, Goldberg was a heel when that footage was being shown, and were supposed to be booing him. On the episode when they were talking about the Fusion takeover bid, they used interview footage of Bischoff's big announcement that turned out to be Goldberg's heel turn. Granted, there was all that bollocks about nothing Vince McMahon can do about it, but without its real context, it just looked like Bischoff was being smug about something that wouldn't actually happen for another few months. The camera never lies, but the editor is a lying prick. Which is a good one, because they get a lot of this in documentaries, and we'll get to more examples of this later on, of creative editing, so to speak.
Well,
and we'll come to the Ultimate Warrior later.
It's not, yeah. I mean, it's not like it's exclusive to wrestling, but this is a wrestling podcast, so fuck it.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. By no means is this something that the real world doesn't do. WWF Chili from the UK Fan Forum with one of my favourites, the WrestleMania 7 bomb scare bollocks that Sergeant Slaughter still insists was legit, and why they didn't run the LA Coliseum. Nothing to do with exploiting a real ongoing war, the war concluding before the angle played out, and Sergeant Slaughter not exactly being the guy to sell out the sports arena, never mind the space capable of housing 100,000 fans. Lou Pickney from F4W also said WrestleMania 7 was moved to the LA Sports Arena due to bomb threats and not because of poor ticket sales. And Seth82 from TPWW also says, Sergeant Slaughter and the WWE like to claim that WrestleMania was moved from the LA Coliseum due to a bomb threat when it's actually due to low ticket sales, like they like to claim. They go with this all the time. The history of the true story of WrestleMania, appropriately named as that documentary is, still features this blinder.
I firmly believe that George W. launched the invasion of Iraq on Vince McMahon's intel.
I think the only reason why, the real true reason that they couldn't sell out the LA Coliseum is because the people didn't want to go and see Sergeant Slaughter defend the title against himself.
Well, yeah. Well, I see what you're saying. Okay.
It's
heinous.
It's just sad because it's like, it's one of those sad ones because it's stupid that he does it, but you can see why. What is he going to do on the truth?
It's a ridiculous excuse for all time.
It's just like the true story of WrestleMania. So it's DVD, like, oh, how great WrestleMania is. And then to actually just turn around on DVD and just said, yeah, we could barely fucking draw a dime in 91. Fuck me. You know, we had to go to like a small fucking arena in the
end. We didn't even sell that out.
Yeah, we didn't even sell that out. We fucked up, you know, this whole, you know, war angle we were doing with Slaughter. It was cheap heat. It was bad. We just fucked up in 91. Sorry. It's not going to happen, is it? So it's just like, they're not going to turn around. If they did that, it'd be amazing. But they're not going to do that. So again, it's just Vince just believing the lie and just.
Yeah, we can't tell everyone that it's all going to ratchet. So we're moving that we're moving to the home of the Clippers. So so what can we come up with? I know. Great, bomb scare. It's great. I love it. But get Briscoe in on this too. But just on that point, because I know Slaughter does still mention it. It is
like Saddam Hussein gave a fuck about WrestleMania 7.
Didn't he give Sergeant Slaughter those boots?
Oh yeah, that's true. That's true.
That's real, wasn't it?
Yeah, they had the little curl and everything.
Yeah.
But,
never mind.
Didn't Slaughter also claim, and someone might even be able to tell me this is true, I've never believed it for a second, that he had that many individual death threats that he started wearing a bulletproof vest, if I'm not mistaken. He's come out with that perler before.
I know. I'm sure there's some... I don't really want to... disassociate any sections of America, but I'm sure there's areas where
crackers,
national pride, and if especially with a military history in the family, would take offence to it. They probably got one, maybe.
There's one person somewhere in the world who took such offence to this, they said, "I'm going to shoot him." Let's move along here. False sanction from F4W with another classic myth. He just writes 93,173. Lariat Tubman from the Wrestling Forum says the biggest one, of course, is the WrestleMania 3 attendance myth. Michael 3165 from the UK Fan Forum says 93,000 plus fans at WrestleMania 3. It's a lie! Don't bullshit! And Lion of the Midlands from the UK Fan Forum says the one that always gets my giddy goat is the WrestleMania 3 attendance. 78,000 is a shitload of people, probably more than all the WCW pay-per-views combined in 1987 drew. This coupled with WWE trying to claim that they basically drew the same amount of people as the Pope did later that year is annoying. I'm not Catholic, but a John Paul II body slammed Andre, I'm sure they would have drawn 93,000.
Like he just made Andre levitate on his own. Yeah. No strings. Yeah, but this one's like the US government now coming out and saying that they've known about UFOs all along. It's like, you know, if we admit we were lying, what else were they lying about? So it's like now they're stuck to it, and it's like. And one thing I will say is, as these myths get propagated by the guys who produce the network shows, they probably don't, half of them don't know the truth themselves anyway. They're only going off the already made up bullshit history. So that's how I think half of these get propagated. But
yeah, so the story goes, just for those who are listening and may not necessarily know the whole story. So basically, they say 93,173 that by the promoter Zane Bresloff, faxed documents to Dave Meltzer. And I believe the fire marshal as well had access to this, that said it was 78,000 in the building. 75,000 paid, 3,000 freebies.
Is anyone really surprised that Vince wanted to make sure that he, you know, he outsold the Pope?
Oh, no one's surprised. This is classic Vince.
I mean,
he did
try to wrestle God, so, you know, it's just all like elevation.
Yeah.
It's like, did he beat God? I can't remember.
He went over. He beat God.
Well, there you go. There's no more mountains to climb, is there, for old Vinny boy? It's one of those ones, just because it's not really one I take offence with, because it's just like, but it is a ridiculous one. It's just like, well, why? It doesn't take it away. If it was 78, would that mean it isn't the top drawing WrestleMania of all time? Is there another one that drew more than that?
No.
So it'd still be the top drawing WrestleMania of all time.
In the history of the company, obviously, SummerSlam 92 is the biggest attendance. And this is one of those things where... where, goddamn, just give us this one thing, Vince. Yeah.
Just admit you're better off. Yeah,
you fucking gave us no mercy. 1999, that fucking shocking pay-per-view on Sky Box Office. Give us this.
And I've got several terrible insurrection and rebellions that followed.
And then, and what was the other one? Is it
Capital Carnage?
Capital Carnage as
Mayhem
well.
In Manchester.
So are they going to break the Mania 3 record in quotations this year, one way or the other, anyway?
Yeah,
by hook or by crook.
Yeah, it's a shame that no one on the podcast will actually see the wink you just gave me when you said that.
And the ironic thing is, they'll probably beat it on both counts, the worked attendance and the shoot attendance.
When it comes in at 200,000 people, that we'll know something's afoot.
Yeah. but there's like a 3 on the end to make it credible, though.
200,003.
Yeah. Funk Doc from Pro Wrestling Only, with one that you mentioned before in passing, Carl. Before Hulk Hogan, wrestling was in smoky bars and high school gyms. Vastardakai from TPWW says the biggest lie of all, that Vince Jr. took wrestling out of the bingo halls and into big arenas. Watts regularly packed the Superdome. Lawler filled the Mid-South Coliseum more than Elvis did. The Sportatorium in Dallas held 4,500 regularly. On the subject of attendance, I mean, that's not even scraping the surface in terms of attendances.
Oh, there was the mention there of world class. Well, how many massive attendances did world class do? Yeah. Just as a it almost sounds like I'm doing a disservice to call them a regional promotion, but as a territory.
Yeah, I mean, you're never 30,000 people at Texas Stadium, kind of
the old Cowboys Stadium. You know, on multiple occasions they did that out in California. How many, you know, regularly selling out places like the Cow Palace?
Yeah,
for example, that there are a litany of territories that did great business in their own backyard. Watts was another great example there.
But Buddy Rogers and Pat O'Connor in 1961 did like 38,000 people at Comiskey Park.
Carl was there.
Carl was there. You're an eyewitness, Carl. Tell us, was there smoke in the building that day?
I don't believe there was. I mean, when his dad was in charge, big shows at Shea Stadium.
Yeah.
Even within the confines of his own company. So it's, but again, it's just one of those where Vince runs the show now, so we get his take on things and we get his underlings' take on things.
Except they never mentioned that Raw during the war looked absolutely shit compared to Nitro.
Yeah, that looked like...
But that's big bad Uncle Ted again. So.
Yeah. Well, you know, that wasn't really all that fair, Kieran, after all. Walnuts F4W says that wrestling started in 1984. No wrestling promotion drew large crowds in major arenas or stadiums until Hulkamania. The NWO was just a group of small-time promoters, and wrestling wasn't mainstream until 1984. So just alluding to what we referred to there in terms of obviously the business was huge anyway.
And some promotions were even on cable at that point as well anyway. Yeah. AWA had their show on ESPN, didn't
World Class was already on cable.
I mean, Vince wasn't even the first one to get on the USA Network. That was Tully's dad, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. Jerry Von Kramer from Pro Wrestling with a really good one here. I rewatch many of the Legends of Wrestling roundtable shows. If you recall the first six of these, they showcased the superstars of the 80s. Let me remind you of whom they dedicated 30 minutes or so to. Terry Funk, Roddy Piper, Hulk Hogan, Bob Backlund, Andre the Giant, Jerry Lawler, JYD, Ric Flair, and Sergeant Slaughter. It's very difficult to quibble with these selections. These were the biggest stars of the 80s, or the most talented. We might put cases forward for other people to be included ahead of those nine. But who is the 10th star they featured? The Iron Sheik. Why is Sheiky Baby deserving of such lofty company? It doesn't end there. The official WWE-sanctioned Top 50 list has Iron Sheik at 31! One place ahead of Jimmy Snuka, above Mick Foley, Kurt Angle, Jack Briscoe, Sergeant Slaughter, Nick Bockwinkel, Dory Funk Jr., and Bob Backlund. He was ushered into the WWE Hall of Fame fairly swiftly. Now I'm wondering, does Sheiky have secret photos of Vince caught in some man sex with Pat Patterson? Why do they seem so intent on spinning this myth that the Iron Sheik was this legend on par with the greats?
And that is, if I'm not mistaken, the first show we've done where someone's got a Patterson joke in before I am. There's one very simple reason for all this. I mean, we've buried some of their top 50 lists in the past on previous podcasts, which, if you liked, folks, or you know anyone who would like them, I'd suggest they go back and listen to them.
Exactly, at squarecirclegazette.com. Thank you very much.
But there's one simple reason why Sheik gets to be involved as the number 10, the 10th wrestler there, why he's put in the Hall of Fame quickly, and why he's ushered higher on that list. It's simply because he's part of the Hogan and the national expansion story. He's the person they use as the transition to get the belt to Hogan, and it's that simple.
It's just shocking because he was terrible. For whatever reason, when I think of Sheik, I always think of a comparison in terms of the way he is historically with like an Ivan Koloff. Now, obviously, it's Hogan, so it's part of Vince's story, which is the reason why. But Ivan Koloff was far better in every single way than Sheik. Far more important, far better, bigger draw. There's no comparison when you compare those two. So I see his point, though, because I find it really thick when they group Sheik into these historical guys.
As a general principle...
Yeah.
Yeah, I find it really irritating. It was bad enough in the 80s. The fact they wheeled him out as Colonel Mustafa in 91 as well was just even worse. But I agree with your sentiments completely. It's just that I think the reason for the situation is just as simple as the fact that it's part of the Hogan story and the narrative that Vince wishes to tell, obviously.
But even by the fact that, I mean, he was fired like 5 times, you know, like you think that he would have burned the bridge enough to not merit this kind of lofty...
Maybe he had something to keep getting his job back. Is it because Hogan gave him an erection?
In that match, maybe. Well,
yeah, was it? You know, and just like Vince kind of looked at it and just kind of, you know, it gave him a bit of a twinge down below. And so, because of that, he'll always put him high up there. I don't really know really about Sheik. On my end of things, I was actually probably more upset that he was included in the first set of legends in Here Comes the Pain.
Well, actually, you did mention that too in his feedback.
That just kind of bothered me more, to be honest. I was thinking, like, Undertaker, okay. Sergeant Slaughter, right. Roddy Piper, DiBiase, okay. Legion of Doom. And it's like, fucking Iron Sheik.
You didn't have to play as
Hillbilly Jim. I know, but just like that, those are spots that could have been given to someone else that's, you know, actually a legend.
But at least Hillbilly Jim, you know.
Oh, no.
At least he was. No, I was going to say, at least he's not involved in these DVDs and given such historical praise. You know? Even though he was trained by Hulk Hogan, allegedly.
Gave him his boots.
Yeah, and his work rate, too. U1 from F4W says, this one is quite topical, but I was reading the Death of WCW recently, and they were talking about the Hogan-Piper matches that started at the beginning of the NWO angle. Now, of course, the NWO was hot, but surely Piper being the face who stood against them also contributed to the buy rates, etc. I don't think I've ever seen a WWE documentary that acknowledges the role of Piper in the early days of the WCW boom.
They don't even acknowledge Piper's importance in the build-up to the first WrestleMania, so I'm not shocked in the slightest that they don't do it for the other company.
Yeah, in terms of this being a McMyth, this isn't something that you can really lay at the feet of Vince. I understand his kind of grievance, because we've been doing this timeline, like we've mentioned here again, squaredcirclegazette.com if you want to go back and listen to the archives, but we've seen it through the course of the first year of the NWO, the buy rates have not been that spectacular, with the exception of the ones when it's Hogan versus Piper or Dennis Rodman's involved. So in terms of, I understand his grievance there, but I can't necessarily say this is a McMyth.
Maybe an element in the early part of the story that's kind of forgotten, maybe. And actually, it's pretty shocking, because you think about it, he could spin that one to say, they could spin it and say, you know, it was our feud from the 80s that got the NWO angle over and got them done. So yeah, I'm surprised they haven't actually done more pipe up Piper and put themselves over.
Yeah, all they did was take our angle from WrestleMania and do it again.
Yeah, because they love saying, you know, they just took our guys, so
yeah.
But they could actually specifically point the finger and say, if they wanted to, that it was the NWO got over as a money draw because of Hogan and Piper from the 80s as well. So,
yeah.
In terms of putting the spin on it, they can even point to the fact that Piper referenced it several times during his promos with Hogan in the build-up.
Yeah. Not JTab from Pro Wrestling Only says, on the Self-Destruction of the Ultimate Warrior DVD, they claim that Warrior turned around on the night of SummerSlam and demanded more money, otherwise he wouldn't do the show, which Vince reluctantly agreed to before firing Warrior straight after the match. They even have other wrestlers like Hogan backing up this lie. Oh, that's terrible, when they're like, oh yeah, yo, do you want us to take him in the room and solve this the old school way?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
You do that, Terry.
The truth was that Warrior wrote a letter to Vince in July saying he didn't believe his payoff for WrestleMania 7 was fair and saying he'd rather stay at home until his demands were met. Still not great behaviour, but better than the mistruths portrayed on the DVD. In the real world, Vince wrote Warrior a friendly letter agreeing to everything before suspending him after SummerSlam. I'm pretty sure he didn't even get fired and was kept under contract without using him. That's one of those ones where, and believe me, and there's more on this Warrior DVD shortly we'll get to,
the straight up character assassination. And it's shocking he went back as quickly after the release as he did, really. How long was it?
It was like 6 months.
Yeah.
Warren thought that he was paid not enough for WrestleMania 7 in his match with Savage. So he said, I want a deal equal to Hogan. Now, this is another little McMyth that was going on at the time, in the sense of Warrior as champion failing, not drawing as well as Hogan did. The fact that when Hogan got the title back and the feud with Slaughter in the summer of 91, Warrior was drawing better than Hogan was in his series with The Undertaker on house shows. So seeing this, Warrior said he wanted to be paid at the same level as Hogan. He wanted to be given the same deal that Hulk Hogan was. Vince said yes, in just long enough to get him in the ring at SummerSlam and do that match that they'd already started advertising.
Right.
As soon as that had happened, then he suspended him because he didn't want to give him the money that he was giving Hogan.
Literally as soon as he ran into the back, chasing after Mustafa. And,
he still had the chair in his hands.
What was he suspended for then?
You're going to need that chair, you need to sit down. I've got some news for you.
Unprofessional conduct was the term given.
Okay.
Moving on to more inaccuracies from this DVD. Maluko from TPWW says, Ultimate Warrior also bothers me. He was so awful in their eyes. They put out a DVD tearing him and his time with the company apart, and now he represents everything noble and great and true about the WWE. That's not even mentioning the fact that he said similar things to what Hogan said recently in public forums, and the difference in their treatment is vast. Chasing Amy Matt from Wrestling Forum also said the Warrior DVD has to be up there. They blitzed him. Then up pops Vinny to make a few quid out of him getting to the Hall of Fame, and suddenly it's nicey-nicey. But the one thing that always stands out to me is they show a poster when they talk about Warrior leaving. Again, there's more creative editing that we referenced before. And they show a poster on the screen of WWF Champion Ultimate Warrior versus Vader. complete with a picture of Ultimate Warrior on the side of the poster, which was a completely photoshopped poster, which actually had Shawn Michaels on the side with WWF champion Shawn Michaels versus Vader, because obviously Warrior wasn't the champ in 96 when he no-showed. So it's just one of those things where they were trying to make it look like he'd no-showed dates as a major part of the show, and he actually wasn't at all. So it's just one of those little things where it's like, the truth is actually enough of a story, but they just have to do these little twists to make it look that much more
that's
heinous.
So malicious as well.
Oh yeah.
Why the fuck would you fabricate a poster like that when anyone who knows anything, any truth, knows it's bullshit?
Yeah.
And anyone who's not going to pick up on the subtleties probably doesn't know the significance of it anyway. It's just complete and utter bullshit, and it's so malicious. And
personal opinion might vary on whether he deserved to be in a Hall of Fame, but obviously from a certain standpoint, he does deserve to be there. But that always kind of bothered me, and it's usually the general Vince business acumen of, after absolutely burying someone, then not just like doing business with them again, because I can understand that. Everyone's always said like Vince will do business with anyone if he can get money out of them, but it's hot, the whole being pally with them again afterwards. I mean, and it's not like a half-hearted one. It's not like, oh, sorry, you misinterpreted what we were trying to do. The DVD's called The Self-Destruction of the Ultimate Warrior. This was a hatchet job, right? And then with a postcard on it saying, you know, fuck you. You know, it's just like, it's so blatantly obvious what they were trying to achieve, because Ultimate Warrior didn't want to do the DVD initially, so they decided, all right, you fuck Bellend. We're gonna screw you over. And it's just this whole thing, like, because you and I watched those little mini documentaries they did in Ultimate Warrior, just showing him backstage and Vince hugging him and so on. It's just like, man, a few years ago, man, you were burying this fucking guy and he was suing you for it. Yeah. It's just, it pushed this image of like, no, we're friends, you know, we're all okay again.
One big happy family.
Same with Bret Hart. Yeah, same with Bret Hart and, you know, anyone else. Hogan multiple times. Wait, it'll happen again soon, I'm sure.
Just to the even point about it being a hatchet job, they might as well have painted the Ultimate Warrior's dick on his face on the cover of the DVD.
It just goes to show that no bridge in the wrestling business is ever truly burnt. Mm. You know, Austin was able to come back. San Martino comes back. Superstar Billy Graham, another example. He's on the Phil Donahue show.
Oh yeah, he's great. I'm actually,
you know, Mr. Molestation of the Mind, Vince
That's
McMahon.
Awesome. That's awesome.
The hatchet job is terrible. Don't get me wrong, and you've gone through several reasons as to why it is, from the Photoshop.
How about the Twilight Zone music?
The
when
Twilight
they're playing
Zone
promos?
Music, yeah. and the WCW run that they're happy to acknowledge there, and they even get Bischoff in on that one as well.
Yeah, that's bullshit too on the Warrior DVD. And like, oh, it failed so much. Oh, Hogan, another person who fucking deserves to be dragged through the ringer. Oh, why would you tell them we've wrestled before? Fuck you, Hogan.
Yeah. You may have just found the only person in the world that's more delusional than Vince McMahon and believes no shit. Hogan's like a whole new fucking level of just like myth busting, okay? Just like, you can just
myth busting.
You can do a 20 podcast run.
The one thing I do want to say about when it comes to these McMiths, and in relation to Warrior and a few of the other names mentioned there, they themselves then have... We can critique Vince for the buddy routine, but they are complicit in it as well. At the end of the day...
It's what they want.
It's what they want, because they want the recognition and they want the chance to make money as well. So whilst we can scream blue murder about what Vince has done with the DVD and the way he treats certain talent, eventually they're all willing to come back. So I must admit, when it comes to the McMiths, I generally don't find this one as offensive as others. I really don't.
Moving on here to a pretty good one. CD Player from Wrestling Forum says, everyone knows about Tony Schiavone giving away Mankind's title win. But this incident in particular wasn't as underhanded as WWE tries to make it sound in retrospect. The WWF themselves revealed the title win on the front page of their website days before it aired. No spoiler warning or anything. This is a little interesting little tidbit there that I didn't know.
It's a bit like one of your bombshells during the timeline. I wasn't aware the company had done that at all.
Yeah, exactly. So the idea, and actually we'll move on to this now because somebody else mentioned this too. Gregor from Pro Wrestling Only says, the butts in seats line and the Mankind title win being some kind of huge tide turning moment. It was big, but the WWF was clearly in the lead by that point anyway.
There's lots of isolated instances which in cumulative effect it's easiest to point to in retrospect. But again, it was a weekly one-off thing, so in the grand scheme of things, it was just another stone in the pond kind of thing, I'd say.
Yeah.
I mean, to suggest it was sort of the watershed moment is false, because, you know, as we've said, Dudev had pulled ahead. It was still a contest by January of 99.
It's still a contest by March.
It was still a contest by all means, but it's significant in isolation of the night itself, because WWF won off the back of that, and it's significant in the sense of it's WCW being sort of foiled by their own tactics, because it worked so successfully in the past. The fact that it goes against them now is an interesting quirk to the story.
Does it strike you as like the amount of play this gets as Vincent was like a nah 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 kind of a thing?
A little bit, yeah. It does get a lot of play, but I must admit, when it comes to the sort of pinning these myths on Vince, and I've never got the impression, you may disagree with me around the table, that the company try to play this off as a watershed moment. I don't really think they do in their DVDs, and more often than not, when they retell this story, it's more about Foley retelling it as the talking head for the section, and just a little personal victory for him, and a nice fill-up for the company to win the night.
I think it's just that extra, like, meh, that little extra screw into WCW, as in, it's not just WWF beat WCW, but it's WWF beat WCW after WCW shot themselves in the foot. It's just that extra little embarrassment on their part to say, nah, you fucked up as well, you bellends. It wasn't just we beat you, but you fucked up as well. You fucked it.
Yeah, I'm with Carl on this. I don't think, I've never personally taken it as they've put this over as a watershed moment and a turning point. Primarily because they'd never do that with Foley anyway, put Foley over that much.
Yeah.
I've always taken it... Oh, sorry, Carl. I've always taken it as kind of what it was, really, that at this point momentum was with WF, and they WCW tried to run their old tricks, which, you know, Vince is all against.
Oh yeah.
And that one backfired, and I think it's used more as an example of the turning tide of momentum for WCW and the war itself, rather than almost a signifier for the war, of the situation in the war, rather than a turning point in the war, I think.
Moving on here, Wrestling Oracle from Wrestling Forum says, so much revision in the Monday Night Wars, which exaggerates the good and bad of Paul Heyman. The Attitude Era was clearly a natural progression from edginess born in 96, as opposed to a pure Heyman innovation. At the same time, the Heyman sucks at business lol WWE narrative is quite unfair, considering while Heyman is shady with a checkbook, ECW was barely structured to last 1 month, sure as hell not 10 years, and a TV deal that ECW got railed on. And further ECW revisionist history perhaps here from LCJ from the UK fan film, he says, the mentioning of Vince lending money to ECW and therefore helping them out, while the evil WCW were the only ones who tried to put WCW out of business. While the lone story might be true, little is mentioned about the members of ECW's talent roster who WWE poached, or the ideas that the WWE stole from ECW during the Attitude Era. WWE seems to conveniently forget that they moved from the USA Network to TNN in 2000 before throwing ECW off and leaving them without a TV deal, which ultimately led to their demise.
Yeah, this is one, it's a tough one, because obviously they're telling it from their point of view, but there also was a slight difference in the business relationships between WCW and WF with ECW, and the story about money to ECW gets retold. I think is it on the Heyman DVD, it's just the $1,000 a week for...
He claims. Then they took the big loan out in 2000. Yeah. Although WCW was apparently also funneling money to them in 95 and 96.
That's what I mean, yeah. So I'm not... I think there's so much is said and unsaid about the both sides' relationships. Heyman propped up probably this argument with his portrayal of WCW himself, but how much, you know, again, that was Heyman just working his own angle and, you know, creating that trench mentality for his crew. So
there is so much conjecture when it comes to ECW and the business relationships. I think it's often forgotten that despite Heyman's rhetoric and Heyman's own issues with WCW, that in 94 they were taking talent and sort of loaning them, for lack of a better term, you know, use Cactus Jack as an example. So at different times ECW had a sort of foot in both camps that's often overlooked. With regard specifically to Vince, it's it's just one of those that's overplayed a lot to sort of show the benevolence of Vince, isn't it? You know, we talked before about how he has to portray himself as the underdog, that, you know, he's the baby face in all of this, he's the good guy, and what better way to also exemplify that than to show, you know, whilst all this war was going on, I was trying to help this other company. We put Paul on the payroll, all those sort of things. It just shows what a stand-up guy he is.
And yeah.
It's all part of this portraying him in as positive a light as possible. Despite the fact, as you reference there, the deal with TNN, WWF, we're also incredibly happy to take talent off ECW. And they're perfectly within their rights to do that in the context of the business and the war, but sickening in the sense of portraying Vince as this stand-up guy.
Yeah, when you think about that triangle, again, just to reference that ECW documentary, The Rise and Fall, there's like that 3-point like run of quotes where you got Bischoff making the very valid defense of one man's raid is another man's acquisition, which was a fantastic speech. Right. And then immediately afterwards, you just got Paul Heyman saying, Eric Bischoff is full of shit. And then it cuts to Vince, who says, I didn't think it was fair to just raid them and give nothing back. And it's like, fuck off.
What did you give back, you fella?
Yeah. And what did he give him in 97? He gave him Bracchus and Phil LaFon.
But on the flip side, they did, was it the Barely Legal pay-per-view?
They plugged them.
But okay, that was, obviously Vince wanted something, like another niche to attract viewers, but it was really putting over the ECW product as a standalone, nothing to do with them, pay-per-view and show. So, I mean, it's a complicated issue, I think, and we probably don't know all the details to really give an accurate summation of it.
Well, yeah, I mean, even Lawler on that DVD says himself where he was just confused the entire time. Wait, how much you want to believe anything Lawler says?
I do believe Lawler there.
But it's just like he's just confused at the time, saying, why are we giving all our TV time, valuable TV time, to, you know, just lowly little freaking company that's not going to draw much anyway?
Well, when you look at the WrestleMania buy rate, he's right.
Perfectly valid point by the King.
Yeah, I think so too. Colin Bollocks is back in. He says, them constantly saying Bret Hart was going to turn up on Nitro the next night after Survivor Series with the WWF Championship if they didn't do the screw job. It bugs me more than it probably should. And Be Quick from F4W says, using Flair's status as WCW champion during the real world champ angle, and then acting like Bret taking the belt to WCW would have been shameful. Also, Bret was never taking the belt to WCW, and they never mentioned that he had creative control, and Montreal was not the last night of his contract. Vince saying he gave Bret a free shot instead of just admitting a wrestler in great shape more than a decade younger knocked him out. That's one of my favourite ones. Vince didn't get knocked out by Bret, he let him have a free punch. What a great guy Vince is, because, you know, I knew I'd done wrong that time.
He's a jam up guy. Yeah, he does that's the confusion about this story, that he offers his chin out to Bret to
take
a swipe.
He needs to repent.
Yes, he needs to be freed from his sins. Of course, then, for years afterwards, he comes out with the old Bret screwed Bret, I have no sympathy whatsoever for Bret.
Here comes the midget.
Yeah, all that diatribe. So, he's quite a complex character, this Vinnie Mac.
It just seems like, I think Bret was being difficult leading up to it, but I don't think Bret would have ever turned up in WCW with a WWF title. I couldn't believe that anyway.
Briscoe apparently teaching Sean some self-defense. Rumour is that the Pat Patterson go behind may have been involved. I'm just speculating. The one thing I would say is, whilst none of us around this table believe that Bret would have gone on WCW with the belt, and couldn't, as you referenced there, Liam, I can sort of see a side to it with Vince in the panic of, well, there's nothing to stop Bret doing this, and I trust Bret, but I don't trust Bischoff as far as I can throw him. And just because Bret's not going to do something doesn't mean Bischoff can't talk about signing him away the night after Survivor Series. But there's nothing to stop Bischoff just doing that anyway to screw with the company and then get a letter from McDivitt further down the line.
So to the point of the McMyth that the guy nominated here, the idea, the way they project this and they portray this, is that Bret had the gun to their head and they had to do something that night when they absolutely didn't have to do anything.
Planned well advanced.
Paranoid about Bischoff and paranoid about probably, fuck, we did something similar with Flair. If I do it, he'd do it.
The kind of other thing as well, like, because there's so many elements to the whole Montreal screw job where it's just like the whole notion as well for a while. I don't think anyone really kind of believed this bullshit anyway, but it's just the whole thing about how much was Sean's involvement in the plan of this. You know, like Sean for like ages always stated that he didn't know until the last moment, that he didn't really want anything to do with it, and he, you know, he always bullshitted to Brett's face as well afterwards, saying that he knew nothing about it. And then, you know, it kind of like you know, McMyth busts itself really as it goes along. It's kind of revealing a little bit more and more.
Yeah,
as time goes on, like Sean actually knew. Sean was actually knew a little bit more before then. And Sean was actually there when they came up with it. And
well,
it's like,
but in terms of busting the myth, it certainly helps from the standpoint of Sean just admitting on Confidential. Yeah, I know.
Yeah, how much covers that?
We're pretty sure Brett's not gonna go onto WCW with the belt, but the fear is that Bischoff's gonna announce that the WWF champion is coming to them.
Yeah.
But the extremes they go to in fucking him over, creating a spectacle which just draws attention to Bret Hart going to WCW, getting screwed out of the title, so it's like the rightful champion still going to WCW. I mean, the attention that drew to, in theory, would draw to WCW and Bret, it probably pales in comparison to... There must have been a genuine massive fear of what was going to happen if they didn't do it, because because what they were giving up was massive anyway.
Yeah, just look at the way that he handled that interview. You mentioned before Bret screwed Bret and that whole thing. He tried to paint Brett as the bad guy and it didn't work.
That's it.
He thought he was going to be able to do that.
For all everyone talks about the catalyst and this being the birth, really, of the Mr. McMahon character, it's often overlooked that that is just completely by accident. Vince was never supposed to become the heel of this situation. He'd attempted, as you say, to paint Brett as the heel, him as the babyface. As we've seen with a lot of these other myths that we've referenced in the podcast, Vince wanted to portray himself as the good guy. It just transpires that it failed miserably. To Kieran's point, you even had the likes of Rick Rude, who appeared on both shows, that even had cutting a promo to that effect of what's wrong with professional wrestling is for Vince McMahon to get a referee to ring the bell to rob Bret Hart of his title. They were so scared of what could happen. What transpired in the initial aftermath was probably far worse for the WWF in that one instant than it would have been if they'd just, you know, worked with Bret and gone along with the original plan for him to drop the belt in December.
Tom Guycott from TPWW Forums, on the subject of Bret, mentions the Bret screwed Bret and says, you know, this was initially an attempt at damage control for Montreal. When Vince came off as an amoral douchebag instead of the hero defending his company, he rolled with it. So there you go. And Jorgavan21 from WrestlingForum.com says, the screw job led to Mr. McMahon? Wrong. Vince was showing signs of the heel turn as early as the MSG Raw when Austin stunned him.
So maybe the whole thing was a work just to, you know, feed a heel to Austin.
And actually, that was the same day he told Bret he couldn't pay for his contract. Oh. It all ties together. There's one for Kieran's conspiracy corner.
Yep.
We'll see.
Add it to the list.
Add it to the list. Here's one that I was hoping would show up, and thank God it has. Pete F3 from Pro Wrestling Only says, DX's WCW invasion was the turning point in the Monday Night Wars.
Yeah.
It's not even the most DX-centered turning point. X-Pac's debut was a bigger deal, much less the most company-centered. Junk Mail Dog from F4W says, the tank segment is the turning point of the Monday Night War, and the Man of a Thousand Posts from Wrestling Forum says that the DX invading incident, not a big deal at the time at all. I'm really happy that this one came up, because nothing bothers me more on these DVDs, whether it's the Monday Night War one or the Triple H one, than blowing this self-indulgent segment that meant absolutely nothing, and you could just tell they thought was so clever and so witty and so smart and so shrewd, and it meant fucking nothing at all. And when you watch those 98 Raws back, they're embarrassments. They're awful segments. They're terrible. They look like such losers crotch chopping outside CNN Center with no one paying attention. Like feral dogs begging for a bone, you know? Come on, give us something, WCW. Digitizing free tickets on the screen. Really? Oh, fuck this whole thing. Like, Triple H had anything to do with the Monday Night War turning around in 98. Suck my balls.
Yeah, and what's it amount to, like you say, it's the digitised screen at the Norfolk Scope, which, if I'm not mistaken, WCW attempted litigation
against them for it. Although, again, they failed to mention that.
You know, going down to the metal shutters that are closed. To me, in that segment, far from being edgy or cool or anything like that, they just come off as a bunch of no-marks.
Yeah.
They come off as so second-rate and pathetic and pandering. I find it ridiculous. Like the emailer said, I think that the debut of X-Pac and the promo he cuts is far more creatively interesting than anything they do with regards to that DX invasion.
Knocking on closed doors, or like, because you're not going to be open. It's just fucking...
It's the screaming child, isn't it?
It is,
yeah. Woo, pay attention to me. Come on, look at what I'm doing.
And, yeah, just, well, I mean, there's a lot of myths about DX as well and their importance for me. Maybe just me personally, but they were just the fucking... fodder for Rock to get over, and Triple H happened to hang on to his coattails, which he's done all his career, I think.
No, I agree completely, Kieran. To me, in the context of that war at that time, they were not the second coming of the Horsemen, and were certainly not as influential as the NWO were in their initial phase.
It's boring. I think it's boring. It's not even funny.
The second one when they fucking get the plane, the plane where they shoot the rocket,
they blow up the CNN.
Yeah, it's awful.
It literally was an updated billionaire
Nacho Man.
Yeah, that's what it was. It was Bush League. It really was.
It was just lame. There's actually, like, to just bring a point. We were watching the other day, like, a preview of the new Monday Night Wars DVD that they're going to release, and they've got Triple H and Sting. Sting actually kind of said, us closing the gates on you actually worked in your favour. But he says, like, if we actually opened the gates and let you in, that would have benefited us more than it would have benefited you.
The angle didn't get over there, that's the thing. It was just complete throwaway bullshit. And it's only in retrospect they use it for stock footage of this war that was going on. It wasn't an angle to go over. It was nothing.
Mm. Mm.
You know, after that, the only sort of time you get is Triple H's "Let's Get Ready to Suck It." And if anybody thinks that had any prevalence in who won the Monday Night Wars, then
you got two words for him.
Well.
Fuck you. Gorgeous Dale Newstead from TPWW says, Vince acts like he created Hulkamania. Not anymore, he doesn't. Sure, he put it on a bigger scale, but Hulkamania was running wild in the AWA before he was running the WWF. From what I could tell by the pops he was getting, he was clearly the biggest star in the country from his time in the AWA. Vince just jumped all over him after Vern Gagne shot himself in the foot and never pulled the trigger with Hogan. So I guess maybe now, actually, he will give Vern Gagne credit these days. But yeah, you mentioned this one earlier on, Carl. Again, and it ties into that whole brass ring thing we talked about earlier on, about how many stars Vince has truly taken from nothing and built up to be a top guy.
It's pretty much... it's just taking Hulk Hogan and putting him in the WWF. You can make that argument for Hogan as well, that Vince, unlike Vern, utilised him correctly. You know, he took the same character, but in defence of Vince, he used him correctly in the sense of actually pulling the trigger and putting the belt on him, which Vern could have done countless times. So I think in Vince's defence, he uses Hogan right in the same way that he eventually uses Austin and Rock correctly. It's just a case of, when it comes to these myths, that the way Vince would tell it is that he takes these complete, you know, unformed, just raw lumps of clay and moulds something out of them, which really isn't the true story either.
Yeah, we said it before, he's, when he wants to be, he's a great promoter. He's not necessarily a great creator of talent.
King Gertner from TPWW, who's upgraded from Bad News Gertner, I've noticed. The worst is Black Saturday. Yeah, they never bring up how the fans hated the change and wrote into the TV stations on Black Saturday. This is actually something that's quite interesting, because there aren't really many DVDs that cover that period of time from the WWF to kind of get a read on it.
Yeah, you get that bizarre scene with Vince and Bob Coddle, which always strikes me as really odd.
Yeah, two people you never see in the same place at the same time.
Yeah, you never saw them together before, and you would never see them together again. But yeah, it's something that the company skirts over for obvious reasons, because the backlash was incredibly fierce, because they'd gone from sort of competitive matches on TV and a more hard-hitting, quote-unquote, southern wrestling style. Which,
thanks,
despite,
Vince.
Which, despite my accent there, I'm a fan of. But they'd gone from that to your typical rendition of, say, Wrestling Challenge or Superstars, which is a series of squash matches.
Boring.
Yeah, boring squash matches with these cartoon characters that fans of Georgia Championship Wrestling... There's a reason they weren't watching the World Wrestling Federation in the first place and were still watching Georgia Championship Wrestling. So, obviously, that you've got the fierce backlash... Ted Turner is so concerned that he buys Vince out of the slot.
Yeah. Buys Vince out of the slot. He puts Mid-South on as well at the same time. Then eventually they both just part ways for Crockett.
Do they give a reason, a bullshit reason, why they left?
Nothing of... So they don't talk about how the fans rejected the show. They just talk about, like, how we had the 1-year run. the run, neither side was getting what they wanted out of it, so he just moved on.
So more gloss over it.
Yeah, very much a gloss.
Yeah, they sort of paper over the cracks and portray it as some sort of mutual parting of the ways, but in general, the company's stance on it is to just not talk about it.
Lodi Lawless from Wrestling Forum says they always say Triple H was punished for the MSG incident, using losses to the Ultimate Warrior and the Dump and Duke the Dumpster Drosy's examples, even though both of those losses occurred prior to the MSG incident. Also, they mentioned pulling him for winning King of the Ring, but if he's actually booked to win, the change was for the best things to happen to the WWE, because Triple H was looking pretty weak heading into the 96 King of the Ring anyway, and it makes me wonder if the whole Triple H was supposed to win is bullsnot. I'm more of the opinion, I don't like the myth that they kind of perpetrate a little bit when they're trying to say that he was like buried for a year. Like they've always liberal with like periods of time on things like this, and Triple H on his own documentary is like, yeah, I lost matches for a year and a half after that incident. It's like, you think he's got a little champion 3 months later, so you went through a period of being in the doghouse.
Well,
sure,
if being IC champ was anything like it means now, he probably was jobbing, wasn't he? So.
Touché.
This sort of treatment of him that he used to like to carp on about. I don't know if anyone recalls the sit down interview he did with JR before Fully Loaded and his match
that's
with The Rock.
Sickening, that is.
Yeah, that's the real height of his bitching and moaning.
Actually, it's not a bad one. Actually, after the day after King of the Ring '97 when he wins it.
Just how badly was he treated? Not as badly as he would make out.
So, are we saying it's more a myth by Helmsley to explain why he really did nothing for that year, when the truth is he was kind of a stale, dull character anyway until he got China and got a bit of attention going his way? It just happens that timescale kind of fits in quite nicely for a getting punished story.
While we're talking about him, Laz from Pro Wrestling Only says Triple H being anywhere near the same tier in both talent and level of stardom as Austin, Hogan, Flair, Rock, etc.
Helps to marry into the family. I think what I find so grating about this is sort of away from the WWF interviews and that sort of thing, you know, with more independent publications, let's call them. I think what I find great is the fact that he really believes this as well. That's what I find annoying. I think he is so delusional. Like, he puts himself in that same category as Austin and Rock.
Yeah.
And I think he genuinely believes it. Or at least he's trying to convince us all that he believes it. I think that's what I find grating, because again, it's one of those where anyone with any knowledge or any interest knows that that wasn't the case. And in terms of even being a genuine main event player, he's nowhere near that before the Foley feud.
No, not even close.
Yeah, it was a great period, but it was all Rock and Austin before that. And it just, okay, well, Paul was there, so let's big him up, and now he's a legend.
I hope it's not misinterpreted. I don't want to completely diminish his role. He was, he was part of the company. He was featured in sort of in the top end of the card, particularly in early 2000.
Oh yeah, top heel for the biggest company.
Yeah,
even company history.
It's not that he didn't play a part. It's just that he is not on the same scale as, not to me, even worthy of being in the same conversation as Austin, who helped turn the company completely around, and Rock. Thank God when Austin was injured, they had someone the calibre of The Rock to step in and completely take up that mantle and run with it. Because imagine if Rock's not there and Austin's gone. Considering how important Triple H thinks he is, do any of us think that that's going to be their largest grossing year if he's the only one?
No, absolutely not. Here's an interesting one, though. Given what the business was when he was on top, not to take away from Triple H, he was the champ and the lead heel in that at that time, especially 2000. How do we compare him as in terms of star power compared to, say, Bret or Shawn?
Interesting. Granted, he did do Blade 3.
But, that's true.
And that might take
him lonesome dove. Doesn't I'm not quite sure.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't see a massive difference between the two in the sense of big stars to the wrestling audience, but beyond that. Green Lawler from Wrestling Forum says, number one, that Triple H had anything to do with the WWF revival, and number two, that Bruno, Pedro, or Bob were actual world champions and not just leads of a regional promotion. So that's an interesting one there. Although, again, this isn't really... They're kind of sketchy and kind of dismissive of that entire period anyway. Another one of his ones was the complete dismissal of Buddy Rogers. But that entire period of pre-Vince is kind of washed over with the most vague of brushes.
Yeah, I mean, like one of the previous emailers referenced, and we've mentioned a few times, whether you refer to it as the Smoky Hall period or the fact that wrestling didn't start until 1984, whichever way you choose to phrase it and frame it, generally speaking, the company themselves are as equally dismissive of that era. So it's sort of hard to bitch and complain about the notion of they call them world, yeah, they treat them as world champions. Well, they don't really talk about it at all until Hogan. The only one they ever reference, it's basically, oh, Bruno existed, and then eventually we got to Hogan, and it's off to the races we went.
And even then, they needed that when they got him for the Hall of Fame anyway. So.
Exactly. It was mentioned for about 3 or 4 months, and it's quickly forgotten about again.
Yeah, so again, I agree, but they barely mention them at all, let alone give them any kind of wider context for, again, just how big the WWF was at that time, or wasn't, I suppose, is his point. LP from Pro Wrestling Only says, from the Divas special on the network, Vince McMahon invented the valets with Savage and Miss Elizabeth, which is one that I've not heard. I haven't seen a Divas special on the network, but that is complete bullshit from old Vinnie Mac.
If it's on there, I'm not watching it anyway.
Yeah, that's there's too many other examples to mention. Miss Linda and Adrian Street and Precious and Sunshine, World Class before, and there's valets dating back years, so yeah, fuck off. Kira from TPWW says, and this is a quote, WWE is committed to embracing and celebrating individuals from all backgrounds, as demonstrated by the diversity of our employees, performers, and fans worldwide, which of course is the quote they gave after Hogan got fired last week. And then he follows up with, as demonstrated by their years of stereotypes and sometimes outright racism, not to mention things like mocking disabilities on more than one occasion, including one instance where a Be A Star poster is visible in the background during said mockery.
It's okay, because Vince wouldn't do anything that he wouldn't let people mock him for.
Yeah, but come on. We're all a little bit racist, right, brother? Nice idea, Shelton.
Yeah. One of my favourite ones, actually, on this was when they did the Crime Time stuff in 2006, right? When they brought them in, but they were so anal about the way they were going to come off. Remember this, Carl? They put that thing on WWE.com where they said, this Saturday Night Live-like sketch will parody racial stereotypes, because they were so fucking afraid to actually make people point and call racism. But yeah, the WWE committed to embracing, celebrating individuals of all backgrounds. Sincerely, the nation's dressing room.
Yeah, they're no sort of leading light when it comes to racial tolerance or just general equality of any kind. That's not
tolerance of anything, really.
Oh yeah, you know, that's wild Samoans. Anyone? No, not even, you know, it's bad enough in the 1980s. It's even worse when you get in the Samoan bulldozer Umaga in the year 2006.
Tajiri as well as Regal's
houseboy.
Houseboy, yeah.
That was great. I mean, the great line from Regal when he's talking about he's Tajiri's doing the barring, and Regal's just like, no, we don't do stereotypes here in the WWF, Tajiri. Now go and get me some tea and crumpets.
This isn't to defend him, but he's not the only one.
No, the wrestling business.
The wrestling business in general, you know, was it Harley Race? What was it, the things he said about
Harley racist
about about Ron Simmons in the build up to that title program? Harlem Heat were originally Kane and Cole, and the theory was they were going to be brought to the ring in chains by Colonel Buddy Lee.
Colonel Buddy Lee Parker.
Not Colonel Buddy Lee Parker.
Colonel Robert Parker.
Colonel Robert Parker. Sorry. Jeez, the last thing I want is Sergeant Buddy. You bust at me, Jesus. But no, there's plenty of examples. I mean, let's not forget old Golden Boy Triple H and the people like you don't win world titles.
Yeah, that's terrible. King Pitcos from the UK Fan Forum says, Cena versus Orton being a legendary rivalry. So I guess this is a myth that no one around this table is really going for.
Can you remember their last go around?
The one where they...
fucking mind-numbingly boring it was for everyone in the world. And how since then they haven't even crossed paths in a hallway.
Yeah. I can't even remember any of their matches,
because it was all the same.
Yeah. I remember the first time they did the match at SummerSlam in 2007 when they were heating up Orton. That was a really, really cracking match. But they had a feud in 2009 where they just wrestled each other on seemingly every pay-per-view. maybe 2010. I can't remember honestly.
Was it during 2009 they had the I Quit match?
Yeah, that period. Iron Man they had in there somewhere.
Yeah, and as Kieran mentioned, their last go around where this was very much in the height of the fans gravitating towards Brian and the company just completely ignoring it. Yeah, we all remember the show in Washington where they're doing the ceremony for the raising of the belts and the fans just completely no-sell it and chant Brian throughout. So any attempt to promote that as one of the great rivalries is just, in terms of Cena feuds, I always found him and Edge far more interesting a feud than Cena Orton.
No, far more. Far more. It's not even close as far as I'm concerned. Platt Yellow from F4W with a pay-per-view as a dying business. As well as Luro from F4W with a similar one. UFC isn't competition because WWE isn't a sport. These are things that they do harp on quite a lot these days, and it's shit.
Do you think they've got like a mutual agreement to both say this bullshit?
Yeah, probably. I to this day, I don't understand why they decided to give up on pay-per-view, other than it was a way to justify the numbers tanking to call it a dying business because they couldn't fucking sell any pay-per-views anymore.
Well, that's it, you know, this argument of pay-per-view being a dying business. Look at what UFC can generate on pay-per-view. Boxing is boxing is far from its heyday. I'm not going to try and pretend any differently, but boxing can still do strong numbers on pay-per-view, and in the case of a Floyd Mayweather fight, do astronomical numbers. Pay-per-view as a business is not dead. We all know it's not dead. The key is booking matches or promoting fights in whatever sport you're involved in that people want to see, and the company just haven't been able to do that consistently. Ergo, you have the convenient argument of pay-per-views are dying business and we're transferring everything over to the network.
Yeah. The argument, I get the counter-argument for me would be, is pay-per-view dying for their business model in terms of how they present shows and the same guys, same the whole roster literally on every three-hour Raw each week? Because when you got every guy on every show every week, if Floyd Mayweather was on TV every Monday night for, you know, in his one segment, it's exactly the same week in, week out, he wouldn't be drawing millions on pay-per-view. And the same for McGregor, Ronda. It's a different way of presenting talent, and it's maybe the current TV model, which is that, you know, it's a consistent regular money earner for him, that is not conducive to the pay-per-view model. So I mean, it's whether it's a self-fulfilling prophecy or working, trying to create a money stream which is more in keeping with their current business model of TV, maybe a bit of a chicken and egg situation, but are they reacting to their own downward spiral or being smart in creating a revenue stream which is more conducive to their current business model?
The truth is probably somewhere in between. I don't want to sit on the fence in this, but I understand your argument of pay-per-view is probably not conducive to the way they operate, but that is through their own inept booking and their own style. You know, they don't have to have every person on every Raw. They don't have to have every person on every, you know, you don't have to have the same cast of characters. They've chosen to do those things. So from that perspective, I do think it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And also it's that context of the way in which it's dressed up. You hear Vince on these conference calls where he references things such as pay-per-view being a dying business. He doesn't phrase it in the way of, it's not conducive to the way we wish to do business and our general business model. It's created as an overarching theme for the sort of the world at large, if you like, that pay-per-view is a dying business. So I think that's where the two sort of conflict, if you like.
No, Kieran's absolutely hit the nail on the head. And what you mentioned is absolutely right when you said, like, they can't draw consistently anymore because they're consistently pumping out product all the time. So it's just like, we need to have less in order to you need to create the demand for the product. If you're supplying too much of it, then there's not going to be a demand. That's what the difference is when you mentioned boxing and UFC. And again, not everything to do with MMA draws huge numbers, but certain shows do due to certain people. So the business model is there. It's not like a universal thing, same as what probably Vince McMahon thought it was years ago, that like just every show will draw. But boxing and UFC know when certain people are performing, when certain people are fighting, when to push the boat out and get high figures, create something that people want to watch, create the demand, then promote it, they'll get higher figures. That's the issue. They're pumping too much out. They need to actually copy the models of others more.
Yeah, but it's your revenue streams, because the reason they pump out the same guys for 3 hours is because they get paid to do so. It's like you compare what a prime time build up show for a McGregor or a Racy or a Mayweather, and that figure itself wouldn't compare to like a Monday Night Raw viewership. You're getting paid one way. The question is, are you making more money by prioritising TV and sacrificing pay-per-view and getting something through the network, or is there a way you could get a balance where you keep your guys as a rarity, like in the territory days more, and you know the early superstars kind of squash match era, and then maximise your pay-per-view? I mean, we could say they've killed it themselves, but they've killed it because they were getting money from a different source, and at the end of the day it's about getting paid, so it's also gone that way for a reason. So
we've got to be careful not to look at everything through the sort of prism of North American eyes, in the sense of pay-per-view, because just because something, boxing in general, doesn't draw as well on pay-per-view in North America the way it used to, you know, a Klitschko fight on the other hand can draw very well in mainland Europe. You know, in the same way a Hatton fight over here would do good numbers over here and wouldn't necessarily immediately translate to a North American
still
audience. it's stand up maybe, but but in terms of your remark on product and the amount of product they produce, that would be fine were it not for the fact that even 10 years ago, when we'd say that, you know, 2005, you know, far past the company's peak, at long after the Attitude Era, if we're really going to claim that one extra hour has such a negative effect on their pay-per-view business and the pay-per-view model as a whole, with the exception of that one extra hour of Raw, they were producing 2 hours of Raw every week, 2 hours of SmackDown every week, you had your Velocity and Heat shows, you had all this oversaturation in the marketplace still, and the pay-per-views were doing far better numbers than they were up to 2-3 years ago. So I don't buy that solely as, you know, that would be a convenient argument for them.
Slapnut from the UK Fan Forum says they're not as bad with it these days, but a few years ago they seemed absolutely obsessed with stats, facts, records more than anything else. Like the way they seem to push the longest episodic weekly running program. That's total McMyth. That's terrible. Yeah. All the way they wanted Rey Mysterio versus Sin Cara at WrestleMania just to get the world record for most masks worn in a building or some bollocks. Who actually cares about any of this shit?
Yeah, to carry on with that, all those are annoying, but also just Twitter.
Yeah, the Twitter
just
shit.
All that bullshit was going, this is the most tweeted thing. Yeah, gives a fuck about Twitter. Jeez, I don't use a fucking thing.
Yeah, that was...
I'm the authority on this.
At Wrestling Profit, follow me, folks. Yeah, let's get Sasha Banks on the show.
Pushing the stuff in your face, hashtag this, hashtag that. It's just like, this is number one.
Unfortunately, that's a product of society in general.
I will say that is actually an example of them kind of being slightly ahead of the curve, because while it was nauseating to us when they first started that shit, and it absolutely was, the whole fucking world does it now. So,
barely a day goes by where someone or something, I don't see some word with a hashtag before, unfortunately.
It's even become part of the political lexicon, where they will look at social media to see what's sort of cutting through to the electorate. It has sort of overtaken all sort of social aspects of life, and it is incredibly great. And the Twitter one really pissed me off as a wrestling fan. It does irritate me, but I will say, when it comes to numbers, you know, one that pisses me off more?
What's that?
Really irritates me because it's just incredibly lazy. Every fucking January, Royal Rumble by the numbers.
That's not a McMyth. That's the real stats, right?
Of course it's not. I fucking worked weights.
Oh yeah, of course it is. And wrapping it up here, Gay as Fook from the UK Fan Forum, who actually has very nice words for us during this week. The WWE is run seemingly from the ground up now as a revisionist carpet bombing of the idea of wrestling as a vehicle for entertainment. The entire contained culture of what the WWE universe is can be thought of as an attempt to paint WWE as the only game in town and what people mean when they mention wrestling. It's a fair shout in some respects, as they're absolutely fucking enormous and really the only federation that espouses the idea that they're producing an action adventure series, but no matter how much they go on about it, the fact remains that they're just fucking a massive wrestling organization. They do wrestling. It's what it's always been and always will be. The same thing as Ring of Honor, the same thing as New Japan, just on an altogether unseemly scale. That's the prevailing mythology of Vince McMahon, that wrestling is the WWE.
I don't think it's as much today, particularly in the last couple of years, when and with NXT, and you know, they've mentioned bringing guys in, and any company in the world should say they're the best and project themselves as being the best, and on the global scale of global reach they are. So I think it was worse in the past than it is today, to be honest. Yeah. I think with the network and, you know, the accumulation of old tape libraries, and this is, I was wondering if this is going to soften their view on history as well, if they're going to start talking about wrestling before 84 because it pays them to now. I think they've kind of opened up a little bit, but obviously there are confines to that. Flair mentioning TNA on the pre-WrestleMania build for Sting was fucking hilarious.
Yeah, I'm not sure if that was
obviously that's the limits of the argument. I think every company should do that, to be honest. I think companies that, if you promote someone else, why
it would be a sort of a dereliction of duty to do anything other than that, really, wouldn't it? You know, I was going to say, you know, it's like Pepsi coming out and saying, you know, please buy Pepsi. We're not quite as big as Coca-Cola. We don't sell quite as many, but we're pretty good. You know, imagine doing that during the height of the Monday Night War. No, WCW is doing great in the ratings, but we're not too bad ourselves. Come check us out on the USA Network.
Oh, yeah. It's like when TNA have done it in the past, and they've referenced WWF or up north or New York, and they come across so bush league, and it's like,
well, they can, yeah.
You're just drawing attention to the fact that there is someone else. And yeah, obviously, as hardcore fans, it's frustrating when, you know, it was great wrestling all around the world and it's not mentioned.
It's a fair reflection of the current landscape, in truth, isn't it, to project themselves in that way, because they're, you know, historically it hasn't always been the case, but for the better part of 16 years now, 16, 17 years going towards the tail end of the Monday Night Wars, they are the show. Whether or not we like that, whether or not some of us are pissed off at the monopoly and the fact that WCW pissed it away, that I've mentioned to you several times, Liam, off air.
Yes, indeed.
You know, this is the landscape now, and they are the show. Delving maybe a little bit deeper, Vince has failed at everything else he's tried. He's been so desperate to try and get away from being just a wrestling promoter. You know, obviously with the XFL... WWF movies, or
Snake River Canyon,
Donnie Lalonde and Sugar Ray. they referenced countless times about SummerSlam 88. You know, he's tried so desperately. Those things have failed. So, you know, you can see why he's going to hammer that point home. Don't think about my other failures. Don't think about the other things I've royally screwed up and the amount of money we've pissed away on Linda's Senate runs. Just focus on this.
Because we have the network. Got this right.
Focus on the Empire. All hail Titan Towers.
I think the point of that, I mean, the build to Balor winning the NXT title, you know, they mentioned New Japan and they talk about Indies and they talk about ROH before with Brian and stuff like that. So yeah. You do get more now, but it's because they are so, on the global scale, they are so overwhelmingly the company, then, you know, they pretty much can do. They don't give a fuck. To sum up, it's not as bad as it used to be, but that's because they don't have to be as... They can give a little bit, but not too much.
Let's not go crazy.
Yeah, I quite like those...
Yeah, don't see them plugging Global Force anytime soon.
Yeah. It's I always found it kind of like weird, those things. I mean, the Balor stuff you mentioned, I actually quite like that. If you actually saw the full three parts and everything, I really thought that was quite an in depth, and even to like a lesser degree on a shorter thing, they did something similar with Becky Lynch as well. They're talking about, I didn't actually know that she'd actually been wrestling for fucking years, and she's been working the circuits for a long time. She's actually very experienced. But yeah, I actually find those a lot more interesting. All like with Kevin Owens and stuff, where guys, I don't see the problem with them putting over something like New Japan if the wrestler in question has a background, because now recently with certain acquisitions the names I've mentioned and like Samoa Joe and so on, they've now actually got a backstory as opposed to, you know, just these cookie cutter guys that they bring in and there's no real backstory apart from maybe they were in the NFL at some point or maybe did some college football and that's about it. So like anything that they've got enhances that talent for me, and even more so when they actually show another product, it just kind of adds something to that talent, in particular when it comes to like people like Finn Balor.
We have run out of time for this week's show, unfortunately, so if we did not get to your nomination this time, we apologise. We will be back next week for the 50th Squared Circle Gazette Radio, and like we said, this is going to be a completely feedback-heavy show, so give us your thoughts, your questions on anything to do with wrestling, past or present, give us your thoughts, your gripes, whatever, even if it's something to do with Carl being an old man. We will get to it next week on the show, and that will be that. So, for G. John Chase...
Wiener, 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 wiener.
For Kieran O'Rourke.
One wiener next to another wiener.
And for Carl Jones.
Did I mention I'm also an excellent crump dancer?
I am Liam O'Rourke and we are out of here.
That's absurd.
Baby, you will never find another girl in this heart.